Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. On the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name. The echo is haunting. The echo is always the same. I call your name. The echo is haunting. An echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life. I'm your host, Bob Ginsberg. Thanks for joining us tonight. We have a great guest with us, Dr. Chris Rowe. Before I introduce Chris, I just wanted to mention that this show has been being pre-recorded because we had pity on Chris. He's in the UK and, you know, we don't want him staying up till 2 a.m. The reason I mention this is there won't be an opportunity for any live call-ins since it is a pre-record. With that, let me introduce Chris. Dr. Chris Rowe is a professor of psychology at the University of Northampton and director of its Center for Psychology and Social Sciences, which includes a research group devoted to exceptional experience and consciousness studies. His research interests are focused around understanding the nature of anomalous experiences, including the psychology of belief and self-deception. He has utilized experimental approaches to test psi abilities, in particular those involving psychological factors. Most recently, his focus has shifted to investigating unconscious measures of psi and correlating these with the behavioral and personality measures. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here after all these years. And obviously, we have a lot of, common interests. I appreciate all the work that you do. One thing that I see is that, one of your research interests involves psychic medium readings and possible cold reading techniques or sitter influences. And, I can relate to that. I mean, one of the things that I've found over the years in trying to evaluate, mediums is that I'm acutely aware that those in grief have a tendency to make pieces of information fit because they still desperately, want to speak to their loved one. So what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, that's certainly true. If people are describing their lived experience or spontaneous experiences with mediums, absolutely it's possible for somebody of a skeptical persuasion to try and explain away their experiences in terms of things like cold reading and overinterpretation of maybe ambiguous information that they're given. And my journey started, my PhD was actually looking at cold reading to understand exactly what cold reading consists of, what it's capable of producing in terms of evidence under different conditions. So we had a very clear benchmark. And then when we speak to mediums and we test those in studies, we can see whether the performance that they're giving, the information that they're providing, goes beyond what might be expected by these conventional means. Always as a researcher, we're kind of hamstrung. We really want to speak about lived experience, but we know that that occurs in a very complicated real world situation. That means that it's almost impossible after the fact to give a definitive explanation for what went on. Yeah. All we can do is listen to people, try and bring their narratives into the laboratory and have more controlled experiments where we kind of test those different explanations.
Yeah, I get that. In my first book, which was about mediumship called The Medium Explosion, I took some heat because I stated that in my opinion that 85 to 90% of the practicing mediums today cannot do what they claim. I mean, I wasn't stating that they were fraudulent, although some, we know, as with every profession, I mean, some are. But I think that many of them had certain degrees of psi ability, which we all do, but they didn't have it refined enough to be able to communicate, with the dead. And were you surprised to hear a number like that, 85 to 90%?
Well, in my experience, we've spent a lot of time working with mediums who were part of the Spiritualist National Union in the UK. And people might be surprised how ambivalent those mediums can be about their experience. I think it's very like a lot of creative practices where people have that inspiration, they have that impression come to mind that they share with a sitter that seems to be accurate and don't necessarily have an understanding of where that might have come from. There's certainly an understanding among the magic community, so that they talk about cold reading and fraudulent practices, but they appreciate that some people are what they call shut-eye people using these techniques. You could be just naturally a very sensitive person who pick up information very easily from other people. That bubbles through to consciousness in a very creative fashion, so that you're not really quite sure where the source of that information is. If for other reasons you identify as a medium, it might naturally tend for you to then think this is some kind of spirit communication that's coming to me, maybe through a spirit guide or something.
Yeah.
Now that isn't at all to negate all of that, but it's one of the narratives that we need to explore when we come to do the research.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I've found, I don't do it anymore, but what I used to do is when we evaluated mediums under controlled conditions, when the session was over, before the sitter gave me their score sheets, I would ask them just for a general perception of how evidential the reading was. And I've had situations where the sitter, gave the medium extremely, low marks with a low percentage of accuracy. And then I'll turn around and I'll ask the medium separately how they felt the reading went. And that same medium would say, I think I was hitting on 90%, So, it's kind of a big disparity between the two.
Not reading the room very well there, no.
Yeah, perception is quite different. Talking about mediumship, and I wanted to ask you this, is that obviously over the past 20, 30 years, there's been a lot of research with mediumship predominantly evaluating evidence under controlled conditions, blinded protocol. Most of the conclusions of these projects was that some people can indeed communicate with discarnate entities without using deception or fraud. I think we've reached the point now where we have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that some people can do this. But I always think, like, where does that really get us in terms of the bigger picture? I think we've done enough of that research. I'm more intrigued now with the wave of brain mapping and studies to see if there's certain areas of the brain that might facilitate, such communication, because that might provide information where we would see a common denominator between things that you study, intuition and telepathy, and then the phenomena like NDEs and end-of-life experiences. Do you ever think that it's one common denominator that's yet to be discovered that describes everything?
I think there are many roads that lead to Rome. I think a number of people can have very similar experiences, but have very different pathways to them. And that's part of our problem. I mean, I think you've captured very nicely the kind of proof-oriented versus process-oriented dilemma. So for a very long time, people have been preoccupied with the proof-oriented focus, which is, can we demonstrate that mediums provide information that comes from a spiritual source rather than, say, just, in speech quotes, a psi source? Maybe they're just telepathic or clairvoyant in some way. And I think we're still wrestling with that, because the meta-analyses, the data that you're talking about from the 21st century, really only demonstrates that mediums are able to provide information that's more accurate than would be expected by chance, and that's more applicable to the client or sitter than would be a standard reading. So there's no doubt that something is going on. But then the task is, the source of psi problem is, can we truly attribute that to a spiritual source? Is this your deceased relatives who are providing this information, or could it be a psychic source? Could it actually be just mediated between us as living human beings?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because that's one of the dilemmas that that we always face in evaluating the mediums, is distinguishing between psychic information and mediumistic information. And that's very, very hard to differentiate. I don't have to tell you, but but the best we can do is we try to educate the mediums by telling them that, look, we understand that you get a lot of psychic information mind to mind with the living, but in order for a sitter to score it as a correct piece of information, it has to be tied to a discarnate entity. I mean, because you could be tremendously gifted psychically, but if you can't show that, identify the spirit, it's not of great value. So that's the thing. I've had mediums say to me, well, all psychic information comes from spirit. What do you say to that? I don't know. I mean, who am I to say?
That's unexpected, I think, as a claim. It's certainly been claimed that even mediumistic communication requires a psi component, because that information is usually acquired telepathically, albeit from a discarnate personality. So there's certainly that element in there. So that's quite a challenge. With the source of psi, just to pick up on that, first of all, there are a couple of very influential kind of philosophically oriented researchers, Steve Browdy and Alan Gould, who I think have captured a key feature, which is the stamp of the personality of the individual. That, and the problem is, as a researcher, it's quite frustrating because you can't nail that down in a quantitative, objective fashion. But there's certainly a feel of the personality of an individual that can very often come through in a communication, maybe in a mannerism or a preoccupation. A student of mine, her mother was a trans medium, for example, and her grandfather regularly came through and was constantly criticizing the family for the way they were managing the sheep farm. And that was exactly how he was in life. So the sheep should have been down from that top field by now. You know, the winter's coming in, those kind of things, which was absolutely him to a T. And of course, the information itself didn't score very highly in terms of the criteria we're talking about, in terms of those scientific assessments. But in terms of the personality of the individual, it was quite kind of compelling for the recipients. And I guess that there's a kind of philosophical experiment as well that people do sometimes to demonstrate, for example, the difference between speaking to a human being and these days speaking to a computer or an AI system. How can you tell one from another? And maybe there's an element of that about this as well. If this person were living and phoned you up, they would be mainly talking in terms of trivialities and general statements, which aren't very scientific, in terms of value. But that's how they are. That's how they communicate with you. If their main wish is to share with you that they're still here for you, they still love you, they're still connected with you, that's their priority.
Right. I agree. And that's a question that we get asked a lot. Why are the mediums bringing through, the fact that I went to the dentist or, trivial stuff? Because exactly what you said. I mean, their main purpose is to let you know through evidence that you can relate to that they still exist. It's hard enough to do that, let alone give us great descriptions of what the afterlife is like, which is another question, that people ask. I was
Could I
interested.
pick up on your, sorry, I was going to pick up on your EEG question because I think that's really interesting. Arnaud Delorme, who's working out at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, recently published a really cool study demonstrating that mediums, when they're bringing spirit forward, have a EEG characteristic which is very different from when they're just imagining somebody or remembering somebody. So that there are distinct differences that are very difficult, I think, to simulate. And that's the kind of research that our work with mediums seems to be very exciting for them. So we've spent quite a long time as the kind of pay it forward. We're very interested in knowing about the lived experience of the mediums we work with. And in return, we tell them a little bit more about the scientific method and how that can be their friend in terms of just imposing a little bit more rigor and objectivity to their process that can help them actually to demonstrate that what they provide is evidential. So we talk about all sorts of research methods that exist. You can conduct surveys, you can do interviews with people, and those are all legitimate and rigorous, but they're not interested. They only want us to do neuroscience. And so eventually we've relented and we do have some EEG kit we bring down with them. And frankly, although none of this is yet published, the results are astonishing, not least in confirming that, yes, when they shift into another state of consciousness, that's tangible. You can show that in terms of the data that you collect. But also just in terms of documenting that there are shifts when spirit comes forward versus when it's not, that they're in a state of consciousness when they're demonstrating on platform where they should be in a fairly deeply relaxed state, introspecting, very quiet. and they're having banter with the crowd. They're kind of joking, you know, but whoever's coming through, you know, they're expressing their personality. There's a lot of interaction. And if we show those kinds of traces to our neuroscience colleagues, they're astonished at the idea that this could be somebody who is walking up and down on stage, on platform, giving a reading for people.
Yeah, that is really interesting. You know, you reminded me, like, many, many years ago, I was working with a researcher, and he asked me to invite five evidential mediums to participate in a study. He was doing EEG studies and looking at areas of the brain, you know, while he wanted to measure, areas of the brain while they were engaged in spirit communication, which was easy enough. And then I suggested, well, you know, if you're going to do that, you need to also have a secondary measurement of their brain when they're engaged in psychic, communication versus mediumistic. So the only way I could figure to do that is I took Zener cards and I sat it, and of course the theory, it's commonly said that all, you know, mediums are psychic. And so while they were engaged in guessing, in the card guessing game, he was monitoring them. But what was interesting to me is that out of these five mediums, which they were all very, very accomplished practitioners who communicate information at a high level, four out of the five scored below chance on accuracy, which surprised the hell out of me, because you think, okay, because they're a great medium, you know, they also have to be great in psychic endeavors. And to me, unscientifically, that showed me that it may be two different skill sets, you know. So yeah, I mean, one doesn't just, you know, I've seen a lot of mediums that I've taken mediums with me to casinos, actually. Good mediums. Like, no advantage.
No.
Yeah. What's interesting, so you examine certain personalities and certain lifestyles that may make a sender in a psi experiment more successful in transferring information to somebody else. So when you found that personalities can affect the process, did that surprise you? Did you anticipate that?
Absolutely, we anticipated that, yeah. So, I mean, the long story is this. So we start with spontaneous lived experience, and we want to understand what's going on in a way that we can explain to those people having the experience so they can understand what's happening to them for themselves. And the starting point is that many people's spontaneous psychic experiences tend to involve very mild altered states of consciousness. People might be meditating, drifting off to sleep, fast asleep and dreaming, and so on. Those are extremely common circumstances. And so I think some of the strongest process work in ESP research has been to try and capture, to simulate those kinds of situations in the laboratory. So I'm just about to go to a conference on Sunday. And part of that is we're going to be doing a dream ESP experiment over the duration of the conference. You know, so people love that kind of experience, and it allows them to explore their own inner mentation, their inner experience, and start to become more discriminating in recognizing signal from noise in that situation. So we do that first of all, but then we think, well, you know, some people may be better at shifting their conscious state. Some people may be better at discriminating their inner experience than others. All of that kind of makes sense. So you're just kind of reinforcing something. Not suggesting it's a unique province of only some people, but maybe some people just more naturally, without training, can express psi more quickly than others. And that's exactly what we find. So extroverts do better than introverts. They have a quieter internal nervous system. So it means maybe they're able to detect signal from noise more easily. We find that creatives do better than people who are not creative, people who don't identify as creative. And that makes sense just in terms of having a working understanding of your inner experience and recognizing the surprising elements of it. That seems to be important. People who practice a spiritual discipline, a mental discipline like meditation or yoga, they do better. And again, it's just maybe because they've acquired a more subtle understanding of those shifts things which are self and things which might be more interesting as not their usual inner experience. Yeah. So all of those patterns make perfect sense to us. They're not enormous. It's not like every extrovert who turns up does well and every introvert does badly. But there are patterns that are strong enough there in human resources terms to think that's, you know, we're starting to get a bit more of an insight into possible mechanisms for how Psy is managed, if you like, by kind of the human biological system.
That's interesting. You know, while you were explaining that, I was thinking what I've noticed when we hold these grief retreats, you know, four times a year, and during at these retreats, there's, you know, scientists and there are metaphysical practitioners and the certified mediums, and we break them up into groups, you know, and of course, even though we're exposing the attendees to all sorts of things, what do people want? They want medium readings, you know. So inevitably, after every retreat, there are people that come up, and the only negative feedback that we get is that people complain that in these small groups, which rotate from medium to medium, the same people get read by all four mediums. And I always wondered about that, because the mediums have no idea who was read before, and yet, you know, they come through with all four mediums, you know, strongly. Maybe it has something to do with the personality and, you know, subsets. And, you know, that's something to that's interesting to me.
Yeah, certainly on this side, there's openness and receptivity. I think it's very possible that people are too shut down to be able to attract a message. So I certainly think there are things like that that we need to take into account. Of course, it's very frustrating when we're designing experiments. So, for example, one of the key things would be that we'd want to randomly select who's going to be the recipient of a message, just roll a die or something like that. And it doesn't happen because the spirit world decides who's going to get a message, whoever's most in need of a message.
Right.
And it may not be the person that we've chosen by rolling a die.
Right. Yeah. And in any reading, there has to be some sort of synchronicity between the three parties, you know, the sitter, the medium, and the person in spirit, you know, because it's kind of controlling everything. What about, you know, that this fear element that people have regarding, you know, Psy? We're constantly coming across, you know, I tell an anecdote or something, experience that happened to somebody, and they say, "Oh, I have goosebumps," and that kind of stuff. I mean, I was just the other day, a friend of mine sends me a photograph, and it was a pretty interesting photograph, which appeared to be faces of people where they shouldn't have been, you know. And I said, "Well, I'm no photographic expert, you know, but I'll show it to some people." And he says, "Well, if it's spirits visiting me, don't tell me, you know." It's like he's a big bruising guy, you know, but he was like petrified this stuff. So is fear something that you encounter a lot when you're dealing with subjects?
Yes and no. So I'll start with no. We've done a lot of work collecting case studies, so people's accounts of natural experiences that have happened to them. And overwhelmingly, those experiences are positive. Very often people cherish the experiences that they've had. They give them a pause. It allows them to identify that they are at heart a spiritual being. Their loved ones who have passed remain with them in spirit in some form. And so I say all of this in a very ontologically neutral way. I'm just giving you the account from the person's own perspective.
Right.
And so these are really valuable, important experiences. Unfortunately, they are paranormal in the sense that in the particular culture and time that we live, they are regarded as taboo. They're not consistent with the prevailing materialist worldview. People who report these kinds of experiences are at risk of being labeled as credulous or pathological. And everybody knows that. All of the accounts that we see, when we interview people, we get the same stories as well. I had this near-death experience. I've never told anybody about this experience because I fear everyone will think I'm crazy. When people do share that experience with some people, that is exactly the reaction, the antipathetic reaction they get from other people, and they learn to shut down. As a consequence, ironically, and because of the cultural representation, so, you know, if you look in the media, anything to do with the paranormal, it's always horrific. They're always out to get you. You know, nobody does very well after a paranormal experience in the
Right.
theatre. So as a consequence, there are a number of stresses for people, sources of distress. Number one is people don't talk about these experiences as if they're as common as they truly are. So when an experience happens spontaneously to somebody, it comes as a surprise. Anything that's surprising, the initial reaction is shock, and that can be negatively tagged. So that's number one. This thing happens out of the blue. I'm not expecting it because nobody's led me to suspect this might happen. Secondly, there's the taboo. Well, I can't talk to anybody else about this, so I've got to silo myself and deal with this in some way. Thirdly, we know that the mental health professions are very likely to medicate you with these kinds of experiences, so we're very fearful of that community. And then we discovered that we don't have any safe space in which to process these experiences. Maybe for me, the best example is after-death communications. So in the period following a bereavement, people are very likely, about 50% of people in our studies, report that they have an encounter with their deceased loved one, of some form. This might be quite ambiguous, might be a sense of presence, but it can be a vivid, full-blown visual or auditory experience.
Right.
And they don't know what to do with that because they discover that if they share that with other people, then it tends to be trivialized or not taken seriously. And they then don't have a space in which they can reflect on the experience and from their religious or cultural background, make sense of it in ways that are meaningful to them. And so it just kind of hangs there, festering.
Yeah.
You know? So for all of those reasons, you can end up with a very negative outcome from a paranormal experience, but they're kind of because of the way that society reacts to them rather than the experience per se.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. You know, I remember a woman that was at a retreat, and she was struggling, and despite, you know, the readings and the evidence, and I said to her, "Let me ask you something. What would it take for you to believe, you know, that your daughter still exists in some form?" She said, "If I saw my daughter, then I would be, you know, convinced." And fast forward, I see her again at a retreat. This is 7 years later, you know, and she comes up to me and she remembers that. And she said, "Can I tell you something?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I saw my daughter at the foot of my bed. I was just in the, had just, you know, woken up, and there she was standing there." I said, "Wow, you know, how wonderful. Like, how, you know, how was that experience for you?" She said, "It scared the shit out of me." And I
Not with
yelled out, and then she disappeared. So, you know, how
it.
unfortunate, you're getting a loving visitation from your daughter, but, you know, because of the what you mentioned, some of the cultural and societal religious influences, she interpreted that as something to be feared instead of something to be embraced. You know, it's terrible. You mentioned after-death communications, and I know so a lot of the people in the mainstream or left-brain thinkers don't accept that as evidence, because most of them are anecdotal, and they say there's no part of for you know, no room for anecdotal evidence and, you know, in scientific inquiry. But what do you say to that?
Well, most medical research is anecdotal in that sense. It's based on individual cases. And so I think it's legitimate and robust in other circumstances. And so that should apply here. But also, I think there are different agendas that we can use. So I think the most important agenda for us at the University of Northampton is to normalize these experiences, to take the edge off them. And that includes speaking to mental health professionals, so that they feel more comfortable that people can disclose these experiences and that they're not apropos anything in particular. So one of our key publications, our key papers on ADCs, is in a psychiatry journal in the UK. So that psychiatrists recognize this is a hallucination in the traditional sense. I think it's subjectively generated. I think it's unlikely to be triggered by something that's environmental. But as we were talking about psi before, you know, a spirit communication is mediated through our unconscious and is realized in the form that we're most comfortable with. So that might be as a visual percept, but I think it's kind of a hallucination in the strict sense. But it's not a pathological one. These happen to normal, healthy people, and that they should be afforded the space to disclose those and to try and make sense of them. So that's an important agenda. In terms of providing evidence for survival, I think there is a subset of ADCs that can be potentially useful. And these relate to a number of things. So first of all, we can disregard the standard counter-skeptical explanation, which is, well, what's happening is we've got people who are psychologically very needful. They're in a situation which is perceptually ambiguous. It's maybe late at night or people are tired. And so something ambiguous happens and you project onto that a particular kind of experience. So that shadowy figure becomes a relative who died recently. But of course, we can show that in our collection of cases, many people are wide awake. You know, it's in sunlight or it's in the electric light. They're in circumstances where they're attentive and aware of their surroundings, and then this appears as part of their surroundings, very often as a very solid flesh and blood kind of experience. And it's only later, maybe when it suddenly disappears, or we suddenly cotton on, hold on a minute, you've passed away. I can't be having this conversation with you. That can happen a few seconds into the interaction. So those kind of things argue against that very glib kind of, oh, it's just ambiguous stimuli and people are projecting. But then beyond that, we also have experiences where people receive information from their ADC that they weren't previously aware of. This may be the fact of their passing. You know, a significant number of our cases involve an ADC very close to the time of the person dying, sometimes in circumstances where they had no clue the person was even unwell. So those stand as quite strong, quite powerful instances that are very difficult to explain away. Sometimes because of the overseeing nature of an ADC, so I'm still connected with you and I'm interested in your life going as well as possible, they might relate to trivial things like, for example, photographs that are in a box that you're struggling to find out where the box is. Here's where it is. This is where I left it. You know, the classic story of where you can find the will, you know, so you can dispose of my property, those kind of things. You know, we have instances of those cases. And lo and behold, according to the accounts, that information turned out to be accurate, even though nobody knew that in advance. So those, I think, are in a different category and could potentially stand as evidential.
Mm-hmm. I'm always curious which has a more convincing or profound effect on people. You know, it's becoming aware of the evidence, which is the path that I took, or having a direct and profound personal experience. You know, my opinion is that it's the personal experience, you know, that's has a transformative thing. You know, I did a survey also a long time ago, and I asked people, if you which would you prefer, to get a communication from your deceased loved one directly or through the services of a medium? What do you think the majority would say?
I think again directly. I think so.
Okay.
Because,
that's exactly what I thought, and when I wrote it, but to my great surprise, the majority said through the services of a medium. And
wow.
So I started to probe that, and they gave two reasons. You know, one we discussed already. The fear factor, that this is something, you know, that they shouldn't be involved in. And the other, you know, segment said that because if they got the experience or the communication directly, they would question themselves whether it was a product of their own imagination, where if it came through a third party, an expert, you know, then they could believe it. So that was interesting. But what do you think in that broader question? I mean, you've done research of the effects of these profound experiences on one's grief and well-being and spiritual awareness and so forth. So do you agree that it's the personal experience that really can take people from a vague hope to a knowing?
I think I'm going to cop out a little bit by saying that I think they're complementary.
Okay.
I think that absolutely. I think that the spontaneous direct experience is personally more transforming, but I think it can be bolstered by an evidence base that confirms that it's not just your subjective imagination. You know, we all have those doubts, those second guesses. And if we can show actually, firstly, that these experiences are very common, but also that some of these experiences can be replicated under controlled conditions. I'm thinking of things like the psychomantium, for example, or those formal tests of mediums that you talked about before. You know, they can give us a little bit of extra steel that girds us a little bit, that allows us to be a little bit more bold and confident in our own experiences.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I mean, as I mentioned, that's the path I took. I needed, you know, after my daughter died, I was having all sorts of things that were happening that were extraordinary around me, but I didn't believe in life after that. So, I mean, it didn't fit into my frame of reference, so I just dismissed them or didn't even recognize them. After I spent years learning about all the different types of evidence, that opened me up to receiving these things, you know, because now I could accept it, which is exactly what you said. So I totally understand that. And we always believe that we have to lay that foundation of belief through the science to open people up to the spiritual. But you know, who knows how that
works. And also because we want to move it on from just a matter of belief. Because I think there's something about the scientific method that can focus on the process elements as well. So we can start to understand the nature of our relationship with these experiences that we were touching on before. So, you know, inevitably, you know, it involves our unconscious self and the way in which that manages information that can make us more or less sensitive to this information. We can either block it out or shut it out, or we can be receptive to it. Yeah. And if we can learn about the methods we can use to refine and discriminate, I think maybe we can have more of those kinds of experience.
Exactly. I know one of your research interests involve Ganzfeld. And
yes.
I guess there are probably many people in our audience that don't know what Ganzfeld is. Or so just give us a little overview of what it is and how you use it in research.
Sure. Yeah, so it reflects that situation we described before, where many spontaneous experiences involve an altered state of consciousness. And so some of the early work involved a dream laboratory where people would sleep in the lab overnight. They'd be monitored, their EEG, when they were dreaming. They'd be gently woken up and they'd be asked to describe their dreams. And their dreams would relate to a target that had been chosen for them, a video clip or an art print that somebody else was trying to communicate to them. So we have that as a backdrop, but few of us have access to a lab like that, a sleep lab. And so we want some other techniques that allow us, for example, to run our participants on a Tuesday afternoon. And the way the Ganzfeld works is very like the situation we put ourselves in when we're drifting off to sleep. So we put somebody in the lab, they have eye shields over their eyes, and we shine a red light on their face. They keep their eyes open. And the psychological experience is rather like being on a warm, sunny beach somewhere with your eyes closed. You get that sense of being kind of cocooned a little bit. You feel safe and relaxed. We put headphones on people and play white noise, which is that hiss between radio stations. So there's a stimulus there, but it's completely unpatterned. There's no signal in there. And the brain quickly learns to habituate to that information. There's nothing much going on. But then it creates a kind of a sensory hunger. So it triggers the kind of the imaginative side of the brain. And it starts to create its own entertainment. So you'll start to have visual imagery in this just red field. So you'll start to see maybe basic shapes, and they'll become more complicated over time. People are normally in the Ganzfeld for about 40 minutes. So by the end, you can have very detailed, vivid, but rather kind of quick experiences. And in the white noise, you might hear embedded sounds. There might be environmental noises, music, conversations. And it's just your imagination. None of that is us as psychologists being a little bit sneaky. And our hope is that they can act as a fertile bed within which to embed a psi signal for that to be amplified. Mm-hmm. And that's what we find. So we ask people to give a running account of their experience. So if you see things or you feel things embodied or you hear things, just report them out loud and the researcher will make a note of them. And afterwards, we try and compile them together to see whether there's any kind of pattern or shape to those things. And we see if they relate to a target, usually a video these days, that's been chosen for you randomly from among hundreds of possible targets. Now, of course, if we simply show somebody the video and say, well, what do you think? Does your mentation match up to the video? People are very creative. They can see some connection somewhere, no matter how tenuous. So instead, what we do is we show them four video clips. One is their actual target, and three of them are decoys. And nobody knows which is which, only the computer. And so we go through that process of saying, well, there's a little bit of similarity here. I quite like this video clip because it's got these features. But this one over here, this has got different features. So I quite like that too. And we get people to rank order them. And of course, we now have a statistical baseline. We know that if nothing is going on, if your thoughts are just truly random, you'll only pick the actual target one time in four, or 25%. And in actual fact, in these experiments, people pick the target about 32, 34% of the time. Now, it doesn't sound like an enormous difference, but statistically, it's astronomical after so many trials that have been conducted.
You know, and in describing it, it's not unlike the psychomantium in the sense it's sensory deprivation. Of course, you don't have the shielding and all the other, you know, safeguards and so forth. But
exactly. Yeah, very similar.
Yeah. I know that Cal has done some research with using the deprivation tanks, right? Or what are they called?
A flotation tank.
Flotation tanks. Yeah.
Yeah, I've never been in a flotation tank, but I'm looking forward to doing that at this conference that we're going to. They have a setup there that we're using. So I'm going to have my pilot session in the next few days. I think it's just very similar. I think there's also something extra about the buoyancy of the water and that sense of suspension from gravity that seems to add an extra dimension to it that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. One of your other research interests is on term it as non-contact healing, distant healing, you know, in effect. So using your mind or your consciousness to affect matter and, you know, healing effects. So tell us a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, sure. So we've talked mainly about what we call receptive psi, which is where you gather information from the environment through means that are not yet understood, you know, telepathy, precognition, and so on. And then this seems to be the opposite. So these are situations in which through an act of intention alone, we're able to bring about a change to the world around us. And of course, there are parallels with things like psychokinesis experiments, trying to affect the roulette wheel you were talking about before. So you go to the casino, you're trying to affect the outcomes of some random process. Yeah. Not with a great deal of luck so far.
No, I've tried it at poker. It doesn't work for me.
And in the old days, J.B. Ryan used to have his participants trying to affect the roll of dice. So they'd have maybe 32 dice tumbling down a platform, and they're trying to get more sixes than you should expect by chance. So the effect sizes there are tiny. But in comparison, where people are trying to send positive intentions to another human being or some other living organism, trying to bring about some change in their well-being, that seems to be a source of, you know, a concentrated PK. So what our first task was, we were commissioned by the Confederation of Healing Organizations to look at the existing literature. So it's possible to run what are called randomized controlled trials. So the kind of clinical trials which are used for any health intervention, a new drug, for example, or a new therapy, they would all go through these RCT tests before they would get a license. And so there's loads of studies that have been conducted in various places. And we brought those together in a single review, a meta-analysis, we called it, to see whether there was any evidence of an overall effect. And lo and behold, there was. And crucially for this meta-analysis, we had two ways of looking at the data. So one involved human beings as the target system. So people who had some health condition they were hoping to have improvement with, and there was an effect in that database. But there was also an effect in another database that involved animals and plants and cell cultures. And the difference with those is we have systems there where people don't have expectations about the study. We all know about the placebo effect, and the very involvement that you have in a study can bring about an improvement in very bizarre ways that are very poorly understood. But we don't really have the same concern about mice in a laboratory or a cell culture that contains cancer cells. Nevertheless, the effect sizes we saw in those studies was very comparable to those with human beings. And I think that's really encouraging that we're dealing with a real tangible effect.
Yeah, one of the early things that had a profound effect on me was when I was reading about the work of Clive Baxter. You know, so he, you know, he put live shrimp at the boiling water at one end of his lab and had the plant hooked up to all the apparatus and saw huge fluctuations at that very moment. That's interesting, you know. Yeah.
It is. We would never get that through our ethics committee.
No,
So.
I know. Well, those were the days where there weren't any internal review boards either, I don't
No.
think. Yeah. You also talk about non-intentional precognition. What is
Oh, okay.
non-intentional?
Yeah. Well, that fits into this general model that I've been talking about a little bit, which is this idea that psi is mediated through the unconscious. That seems to be the model. I'm very influenced by the work of a guy called Charles Honiton, and he came up with what's called the noise reduction model. And within that, he argues that psi operates when we're awake. You know, we don't make vision happen. We just open our eyes. We don't make audition happen. It just happens when we're consciously aware. If there are stimuli which are sound based, we just naturally pick them up. And within this model, we're constantly scanning our environment for information that's advantageous to us to realize opportunities and to avoid threats. And sometimes that comes about through a vivid experience, something that's conscious. So we avoid that train crash or we avoid that road accident because we have a vivid impression. But very often you can achieve the same outcome without any conscious component. If, for example, you're in a bookshop browsing the shelves and something just catches your eye and you linger in the bookshop for an extra 5 minutes, you wouldn't think anything about it. But that might be just the time you need to linger so that when you step outside, you bump into an old friend and you're able to capitalize on that chance interaction. Well, how chance is that? Maybe there was something that coordinated that. You were scanning your environment, noticed an opportunity, and you changed your behavior in a way that even you didn't know about, particularly.
Yeah.
And so there's a line of research that explores that to see whether people can make judicious choices or behave in the right kinds of way to bring about positive outcomes. So it's kind of an ESP task, but without people feeling like they have to be psychic, you know, they just have to sit there and look at a screen and react to the stimuli that they see and not worry too much about it. And it seems to work.
Yeah, and it's a non-threatening environment, right? You're just guessing,
Yeah, well, sometimes the environment's not that non-threatening. So one of our preferred methods is to show people images, and some of them are rather kind of banal, kind of tree-lined avenues, but others are quite horrible pictures of people with injuries and diseases and things. And we've discovered that people are reacting in advance, steeling themselves for a horrible picture, relaxing a little bit more because it's going to be a nice picture, and they're doing that before the computer's even chosen what the next picture is going to be.
I was always fascinated by Charles Tartt's work, especially that case with Mrs. Z, and he planted a, I think it was a 4 or 5 digit number way up where it was out of sight and doing dream studies, and yet, her consciousness left her body and she saw the number. I mean, that was another one of those things when I was doing my own, research, saying, what well, how is that possible by physical means? I mean, if you could rule out fraud, it's clearly something's going on, that we're more than our physical bodies. I mean, I think that's why it's very important for people to learn about many of the things that you study, because by showing your research shows that our minds or our consciousness can extend beyond the body, and we're specifically interested in that because if our mind can operate independently of the brain and extend beyond the body, it's not illogical to assume that it continues after the body goes away. So I always encourage people to learn as much as they can about the work that you do, because that will lay a foundation for belief.
I think so. They're very much complementary, and they do all speak to the notion of an extended mind. So we talked about the materialist worldview earlier on, and one of its key tenets is that consciousness is a byproduct of brain activity, so that when the brain perishes, so does everything about you, your thoughts and your fears, your memories and your emotional connections to others. And all of these lines of research speak to the idea that that's a very impoverished view of what people are capable of and what consciousness is.
Do you subscribe to the brain as a filter model?
Yeah, I'm very well. I'm at least I'm intrigued by it. I think some of the more recent research, particularly for example, the kind of enhanced brain activity in people near to death, actually fits with a filter model as well. And I think it's very possible that the little techniques that we're using, things like the Ganzfeld, are ways to dislocate the ego self, which is responsible for that. That kind of filtration for select for censoring for deciding what's going to pass through to consciousness and what isn't. That's all related to that sense of ego self. And I think many of the strongest spontaneous experiences happen when people have a dissolution of ego. They feel at one with the system that they're interacting with rather than separate from it. And so for me, that speaks to the idea that if we can knock out the filter, suddenly our awareness is naturally expanded and we can focus on these additional things.
Yeah, and that explains why so many people report having these dream visitations and various stages of sleep, because the chatter mind is at rest and there's a conduit that, you know, that opens up. So it explains a lot of things. Well,
Absolutely.
I know we could talk about your stuff all day, but at some point, you know, we're nearing the end. Is there a way for people to learn more about the work that you're doing? Will you direct them to a specific site or?
Yeah, so I don't have a personal website, but certainly if they're interested in the ADC research, we have a specialist, a devoted website to our ADC project, and we can provide you with a link to that if that's useful.
Okay. And
And
well,
also, Professor Chris Rowe, ROE,
okay.
I'm quite Googleable, I think.
Right. And you can also Google, you know, as you said, Chris Rowe, or I suppose the University of Northampton, and
Yeah.
you know, you find out about the division that you work in. So Chris, it's been a pleasure to finally meet you. I know you're a
You
wealth of
too.
information, and I hope we get to talk more. And I really enjoyed our talk today. So I thank you so much for being with us,
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
and I hope to talk to you again soon. Good night,
Great.
everyone.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.